I've yet to come to terms with the fact that I've become a respected filmmaker, respected voice in the art world, where, you know, only 6 years ago I was just still, you know, rushing. I was actually conducting renovation work in at a motel in Alabama. And now I'm here talking to you on radio. So I haven't come to terms with that, and I'm not ready to let go of my roots, which is my comfort zone, being with the outsiders. And so it comes very natural for me, and I like it. The struggle that I see, again, there's no, and I hope people who watch my films understand that there's no really a paternalistic view from me.
The director Roberto Minervini there describing the inspiration behind his latest film exploring America's dark underside, The Other Side. We'll cross to Monocle's New York bureau to hear more from him soon. Also ahead today, how do you turn mathematics into something worthy of the cinema screen?
An actor like myself who looks the way I do, it's very rare to come across something that's so meaty, that's period. And I knew once it got off the ground, it was going to be surrounded by stellar actors.
We'll assess the new film recounting the fascinating story of a rather unlikely mathematical genius in The Man Who Knew Infinity. And we'll take a trip to California's San Fernando Valley as we revisit the world of 90s comedies.
I remember not really getting any of the jokes in it, but just being like, wow, it's so colourful and they're so grown up and the music's so cool.
That's today on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of movies on Monocle 24. Hello, from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Ryland. We'll talk to Roberto Minervini in a moment. First, however, let's take a look at one of the films hitting theatres this week. The Man Who Knew Infinity is the true story of a maths genius who went from near poverty in Madras to becoming a fellow of the Royal Society here in London. First-time writer-director Matthew Brown is aiming high, with the posters littered throughout the Tube here in London, confidently boasting comparisons with 1997's Good Will Hunting. This film probably isn't on that level, but it's not without its strengths either. Let's take a look.
Why do you do it, any of this?
Because I have to. I see it.
Like Euler, form for its own sake, an art unto itself. And like all art, it reflects truth. It's the only truth I know. It's my church. And you, just as Mozart could hear an entire symphony in his head, you dance with numbers to infinity. But this dance, this art, does little to endear us to certain factions who see us as mere conjurers. So if we are going to challenge areas of mathematics that are so well trod, we cannot afford to be wrong.
Indeed, and nor can the film, it seems. There's always a delicate tightrope walked by films pertaining to be based on true events. Do you stick firmly to the truth and risk criticism for lacking a dramatic core? Or does the medium of cinema allow for at least some degree of flirtation with fiction? The Man Who Knew Infinity falls somewhere in between. Srinivasa Ramanujan was a mathematics genius from the most unlikely of origins, that being Madras of the early 1900s. He came from an impoverished background and yet, despite having no formal training, somehow became a genius with numbers. In fact, according to the film, he believed he was blessed with the long, almost poetic equations by God himself, who would place them upon his tongue while he slept. The film begins with Ramanujan in search for work in Madras. As you might expect, his scruffy appearance is enough for just about everyone to issue a stern not interested before he's been given much of a chance. He happens upon some better luck, however, when he meets Sir Francis, played somewhat fleetingly by Stephen Fry. He's soon working as a bookkeeper, but it's when his long letter of equations is finally answered by a gruff G.W. Hardy, wonderfully played by Jeremy Irons, at Britain's Trinity College, that the film finally switches into gear.
Is Mr. Hardy here? I'm most excited to meet him. He must be a very kind man to bring me all this way.
Ah, speak of the devil.
Hello.
I'm Hardy. Welcome to Trinity, Mr. Ramanujan. Am I pronouncing that properly?
Yes, sir. Perfectly. It's an honor, sir.
Thank you. I very much look forward to beginning our work. So, tomorrow, 10 o'clock, my rooms. I look forward to it.
Did I say something wrong?
Now, let's be honest, maths isn't exactly the most popular subject at school, and making a movie about the topic probably won't have you feeling nostalgic for long, sunny afternoons spent solving even longer equations or discovering the secret to something called partitions. Wisely, writer and director Matthew Brown isn't so concerned about making us see these long, complex puzzles through Ramanujan's eyes. Instead, much of the conflict here is quite delightfully left to our pair of very competent lead actors. Trinity College in the lead-up to 1920 certainly wasn't a place accustomed to mathematical geniuses from faraway lands who burn incense and repel at the thought of potatoes cooked in lard. But while much of the film feels pretty much as you might expect, the relationship between Ramanujan and Hardy is actually quite touching. The casual observer might merely see the stern confidence of Hardy opposite Ramanujan's frightened outsider, but a closer look suggests that those roles might actually be around the other way. The film probably won't have you digging up your old textbooks with eager excitement, but there are some wonderful performances here from Dev Patel and, well, one doesn't need much of an excuse to spend 2 hours with the deliciously biting Jeremy Irons now, do they?
Ooh, I quiver with fear.
Thank you, Jeremy. Now, since he came to prominence in the UK television series Skins and the 2009 Best Picture Oscar winner Slumdog Millionaire, Dev Patel is proving to be quite a player among the acting elite, something which, by his own admission, is made that much harder by the lack of diversity on our screens. Let's hear a few words now from Patel and his co-star, Jeremy Irons.
An actor like myself, who looks the way I do, it's very rare to come across something that's so meaty, that's period. And I knew once it got off the ground, it was going to be surrounded by stellar actors that I was going to be able to act opposite. It's a film that doesn't rely on CGI or effects or anything like that. It's a very performance-driven film about two humans with very different ideals, which I thought would be an amazing journey to go on. The mathematics is incredibly difficult to grasp, if not impossible for someone like myself. We had a really amazing guy called Ken Ono, who guided us through the complexities of it all, taught me a couple equations that I could write out lightning fast. I used to practice that every night with a friend of mine.
The thing that interested me about The Man Who Knew Infinity was, it was a story I knew nothing about a man I knew nothing about. It does contain passion and wonder and mystery and art.
Dev Patel and Jeremy Irons there discussing their roles in The Man Who Knew Infinity, which is out in theatres today. Italian director Roberto Minervini grew up near Monte Urano, a small town in the region of Marche. In his own words, it's a place you wouldn't know about. For many filmmakers, the influence of youth can be forever traced in their progressing work. Now I'm thinking of Tim Burton's youth in suburban Los Angeles, reflected in Edward Scissorhands, or the satirical pretense of Woody Allen's New York films. But in that school of thought, Minervini is quite an enigma indeed. His trilogy of Texas-set films is currently screening on Mubi for subscribers here in the UK. And he joins me now from our bureau in New York. Roberto Minervini, it's a pleasure to be talking with you. First up, perhaps I think we need to get to the bottom of the most pressing question. For an Italian-born director, why Texas?
It's a long story of an immigrant. I moved right after college out of Italy, went to Spain, ended up in the United States for the love of a woman. Then I moved to the Philippines and then back to Texas, always in search for, you know, jobs, odd jobs, office jobs to make ends meet. So in the Philippines, I was a film teacher, and then in Texas, I've become a real estate broker. So, but then I stayed. And then usually being always an immigrant, I think I've been always moved by the, you know, wanting to belong. So I always interested in getting to know people and places very deeply. And that's why I've stayed in Texas for the past 9 years.
So your debut feature film then that was in the Texas trilogy,
Of course, it had that air of darkness about it as well, and you were just speaking to that. But there was also the addition there of the main character who seemed to be coming to terms with the fact that she will die. And, I mean, that kind of gave it an even darker air to it. Where did that come from?
When I moved to Texas, my mother-in-law was ill, terminally ill with cancer. And at the time, I had part of my own, I would say, rebirth was also embracing Buddhism, and I've been a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism since then. We're talking almost 10 years now. So I was a companion to my mother-in-law until her, you know, last days, trying to make sense of this journey that was, you know, this transition to death. And that, you know, it became, I translated all that experience journey into images, and I found a woman who had survived to terminal, you know, cancer, to stage 4 cancer, and together, which is the woman in The Passage, my first film, and together we kind of reenacted a story that I was living with my mother-in-law, and the story is about this journey, letting go, really, of control over a destiny. There is just awaited her and awaits a lot of us, probably more, as far as I'm concerned, all of us. So, you know, it's interesting you say darker, because Buddhism is considered the most nihilist, pessimistic of all of spiritual philosophies. But there is something very matter of fact about it. And it's very liberating, very beautiful in a way. It's matter of fact. I mean, there's a journey, and there's a finish line in this journey, and what are we going to do about it? So there was something very, very beautiful about embracing this journey and letting go of the end result.
With it being such a personal project for you then as well, especially that part of the story there, do you think that covering these sorts of themes in your art goes somewhere to help heal those sorts of experiences that you have been through yourself in the past? And also, I suppose, the addition of those other two characters who themselves came from quite sad existences as well.
Absolutely. There is something cathartic about it, so very healing for myself. There is something about wanting to matter, like the characters of my film. I want to matter. I want to be visible. I want to not to be invisible. So I want to have, you know, in my, even if small, a little bit of a voice and, you know, telling stories. And there is something about creating a legacy. I'm a father now, and I know that my films will outlive me. And I know that that's really what I'm going to do, you know, the legacy I'm creating, the inheritance that I give to my children. And all of that goes into my films and goes into the decision process when I choose a particular subject. And again, it sounds heavy, I understand, but it's actually extremely joyful and liberating and fulfilling to tell stories that I believe in. And it's just a great feeling to go to bed every night, look at myself in the mirror and feel good about what I do. And yeah, it's a very beautiful thing.
We'll hear more from Roberto Minervini later on in the show. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, but we're going to need to put the brakes on for a moment now, because I'd like to invite you to a 21st birthday party. But this isn't your average backyard gathering. We're off to what's colloquially known as the Valley, and they do things a little differently there. Every now and then, a film comes along that enters our vernacular and almost creates a whole world of its own. Well, back in 1995, writer and director Amy Heckling performed a feat of generational summation after leafing through the pages of a most unlikely source, Jane Austen's 1815 novel, Emma. The film in question is, of course, if you hadn't guessed, Clueless, that bright pastel-inspired take on high school life in the 90s in Los Angeles. The film is showing now for Mubi subscribers here in the UK, so let's jump in the back seat with Cher and Dion and Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph here in London, for a ride back to the 90s.
From now on, we're alternating Cindy Crawford's Aerobicize and Buns of Steel and reading one non-school book a week. My first book is Fit or Fat.
Mine, it's Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus.
I think Clueless was definitely a sort of sleepover movie. I basically wasn't really quite old enough to be allowed to watch it when it first came out. I remember not really getting any of the jokes in it, but just being like, wow, it's so colourful and they're so grown up and the music's so cool.
Lucy, where's my shirt?
Probably at the cleaner.
Oh, but today's the driving test. It's my most capable looking outfit.
What's up, Daddy?
What the hell is that?
A dress.
Says who?
Calvin Klein.
It looks like underwear.
I think what's interesting about the fact that Amy Heckling picked up on Austin, picked up on Emma, is that, you know, she said that she was reading this when she was trying to get an idea for the film, and she was just so taken by the fact that these themes that are hundreds of years old are still so relevant to teenage life. And I think that is partly why Clueless has universal appeal, because regardless of whether cell phones are the size of a lunchbox or not, you're still going to want to get the guy, you're still going to want to match make, all of those feelings come through. But it also just gives it a really proven storyline, which really works.
I'm amazed.
That I'm devoting myself so generously to someone else?
No, that you found someone even more clueless than you are to worship you.
I am rescuing her from teenage hell. Do you know the wounds of adolescence can take years to heal?
The interesting thing about the Valley Girl persona and the way that that very privileged Beverly Hills high school theme is embodied in Clueless is that Amy Heckling came to it always from a really positive perspective. So she said, oh, I want this kind of this go-getter, really positive character. Another inspiration behind Cher was a character called Gidget, which is like a 1960s surf TV show. So she wanted someone who's really positive and really happy. And I think it could have been easy to make the Valley Girl this kind of mean, you know, completely obsessed shopping freak. But she's ultimately kind and she wants to do the right thing. And the characterization comes through because there was a lot of improv on the set. So a lot of those characters brought weird words in, or the teenage stars were asked for how they would say the words. So you don't end up with this such a rich satire or a complete direct, like, Mickey take of what's actually happening. It's this weird kind of hybrid, almost a hyper-real version of the Valley Girl.
I just don't want this whole fucking Watergate business biting me in the ass. You know the goddamn Jews are out to get me.
You know, a lot of people are talking about this Watergate thing, and they all say that you lied,
and I'm Jewish.
About 4 or 5 years later, there's a film called Dick that was released, and what happened there was that basically the kind of Clueless-style 15-year-old was placed into the reimagining of the Watergate scandal, which just, I mean, it just sounds ridiculous, and it shouldn't have worked, but it did. It got really good reviews. And so, yeah, this is this kind of take of very silly, funny, appreciated rewriting of history where there's a 15-year-old adolescent who's obsessed with Richard Nixon, who's, you know, an unintentional whistleblower and the whole thing. And I think that wouldn't have been able to happen without Clueless and that kind of affectionate treatment of teenagers, but also an understanding that they do have an impact on adult lives as well.
Light as a feather, stiff as a
board. I thought it too.
Well, I thought it too. Without
Sarah, did you think it?
Yeah.
Well, then that's it, you guys. Sarah's a fourth. North, south, east, and west. We can make things happen. I mean, this is it. This is real.
The Craft is another one of these kind of cult, post-Clueless, kind of funny, kind of knowing, but quite dark films. I mean, if you sort of read the plot for it, you'd be like, oh, goodness, this is horrible. There's, you know, girls having their hair falling out due to spells and teenage boys becoming obsessed, and there's this, like, summoning of the moon and stuff. But really, at its heart, what it looks at is how teenage girls can become fascinated with witchcraft, but also femininity and friendship and what happens when there's a new girl and power struggles and all these things that not just women but people deal with throughout their lives. The interesting thing about 90s teen movies is that they came after a slightly flabby period of there wasn't very much around for teenagers. And this is because John Hughes left such a massive legacy. So, you know, 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink. John Hughes was kind of this oversized teenager himself who made these brilliant films. But then what was interesting in the 90s is that we definitely saw a move on from that. It was indebted to that, definitely, in that kind of playful, affectionate look, social cliques, all the kind of tropes that became the making of a teen movie. But moved it on, so what was interesting with the Amy Heckling thing was that the studio didn't originally want Clueless to be made because they thought it was too female-focused. And I think that what was really important is by Paramount taking it on and getting a narrative from a female point of view, written by a woman, produced by a woman, having such a female focus, that led the way to things like Dick and things like The Craft.
Alice Vincent there from The Telegraph here in London, taking us back to the Valley with 1995's Clueless. That is one of many films playing on Mubi right now, which, of course, is the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And let me remind you of a special treat happening at the moment just for you, a whole month of free movies. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Up next, we'll hear more from director Roberto Minervini.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Director Roberto Minervini is still with me at our New York bureau. Roberto, let's talk a little bit about your new film now, The Other Side, which takes us to Louisiana. Was there something in particular that led you there?
Sure. The main female character, Lisa, she's the aunt of the bull rider that was featured in my previous films, actually, Stopped Upon the Heart and Low Tide. So again, even if this is my first film that I shot outside of Texas, there are family ties, there are human connections that led me there. Why do I do that? Why do I move through, you know, the human connections of, you know, why? Because that is a precondition to, you know, creating intimacy and mutual trust. So what led me there were, you know, friends in common. We have friends in common. And that's that was a good starting point.
Put Hillary Clinton in.
She's going to be our next president for sure.
Hillary in for the president. I'm going to vote for her.
Well, when Bill Clinton was president, you know Hillary was the one that's calling the shots anyway.
Yeah, and
it's time for a woman to run it. You know why? Because a woman always runs a man anyway. You know that.
She's going to be the best.
You know good and well, there's behind every good man. Is a great woman and a smart woman.
This is a documentary, which by its definition might seem easy enough to imagine, but even your narrative films, they seem to exist in their own form of reality. Tell me about where you think The Other Side fits into all of that when considering how your other films have really come to construct themselves.
Yeah, so my view of cinema and making films hasn't changed since the beginning. I've been always trying to tell stories that are very real and they belong, they're pertinent to the characters, to the people involved in the story, the interpreter, the ones who interpret a particular subject. I sometimes switch from, like in The Passage, people who are just reenacting a story that was their story in the past. So in a way, I've documented their past. So I switched from documenting someone's past to documenting someone's present. But my approach, my view on you know, my willingness to tell a story, a real story, a chunk of reality and realism, hasn't changed. I feel very safe when I'm grounded in reality. And that's what I've been doing all the time. So for me, switching from fictional characters in a way, which weren't really fictional, to real characters who are also able to tell a big story, sometimes with reenactment. So my approach hasn't changed at all. It's just the circumstances have changed. But that has very little to do with my filmic approach, which is almost a consequence of the situations I'm trying, or the stories I'm trying to tell.
Do you think that there is perhaps some sort of, I don't know, air of responsibility on independent filmmakers to pick up on what might be described as the real stories?
I think there is. I personally, there is. I feel that sense of responsibility, for sure. I've been in America for 15 years, and in a way, I just came after the, you know, the startup, the dot-coms, you know, the startup explosion, boom. And I started observing what had happened to the manufacturing, you know, industry in America, which us as European, we know very well. You know, we were built thanks to manufacturing industry. And, you know, it's, I mean, this incredible rise of America, of the startup businesses and America's services, right, providing as a service provider, has annihilated the manufacturing industry, but there's a lot of people who live, you know, off manufacturing jobs, and there's a lot of, you know, people who are today live in despair, completely abandoned. So it's always interesting, and I've always wondered what happened to these people. And I started my explorations, you know, I found out that, you know, the rural areas of America where, you know, they're completely, they've been wiped out. And it's incredible to see what they did with the excess of fertilizers, where actually they made methamphetamine, because fertilizer contains one of the most, the active principles of methamphetamine, which is one kind of ammonium. So it's been interesting to see this tremendous shift in the economic structure of America, you know, the consequences of it, and how entire populations have been wiped out. And for me, it's chance. It's that I have, and a responsibility that I feel to tell some stories there of parts of America that have been completely left behind.
So I suppose by necessity, then, you must spend quite a bit of time in that part of America, in those sorts of communities around that sort of existence. Does any of that air of hopelessness ever rub off on you? Do you ever feel yourself just thinking like you need to break away from it somehow and get back to who you are?
In a way, I get bored very easily, and I've yet to come to terms with the fact that I've become a respected filmmaker, respected voice in the art world, where, you know, only 6 years ago I was just still, you know, rushing. I was actually conducting renovation work at a motel in Alabama. And now I'm here talking to you on radio. So I haven't come to terms with that. And I'm not ready to let go of my roots, which is my comfort zone, being with the outsiders. And so it's just very, it comes very natural for me. And I like it. The struggle that I see, again, there's no, and I hope people who watch my films understand that there's no really a paternalistic view from me of these people. I'm not trying to induce sympathy. I'm not trying to send messages of salvation that people want to be saved. I'm actually, you know, channeling sometimes their anger, but I'm definitely trying to give them the dignity they deserve. And because I'm with them from that standpoint, I understand the struggle, and I understand, but there's something very, again, very primordial, very human to belong to the underworld. It makes me feel alive, paradoxically, because sometimes to be alive, it's actually, it feels very close to self-destruction and death. But I do belong, I do feel very comfortable with the outsiders, and so I'm part of all that.
And that's it for this week. My special thanks to our guest today, Roberto Minervini. Be sure to catch his latest film, The Other Side. Whether you're from Madras or Monte Urano, being an outsider can often be one of the greatest motivators for any creative mind. And don't forget to catch Minervini's Texas trilogy on Mubi if you're here in the UK. Today's show was lovingly edited by Nina Norek and researched by Yulian Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, and remember to subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, SoundCloud, or your podcatcher of choice, of course. And The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.